Holmes v. Potter. Mr. Massey?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is David Massey, and I'm proud to represent Mr. Rochester Holmes, the plaintiff appellant in this case. And we're asking this Court to reverse the decision of the federal magistrate granting summary judgment in favor of the government and to allow Mr. Holmes to have his day in court to show that it was the intent of all parties in this case at an EEOC mediation that Mr. Holmes receive a full retirement. Now, there was an EEOC settlement conference held May 26, 2004 in this case. Federal mediator represents. He's familiar with the federal retirement system. He goes from room to room, represents to Mr. Holmes. This is the amount you're going to get, $34.51 per month. This is the amount you're going to get in exchange for the settlement of his EEOC claims that the government, the Postal Service, violated the Federal Rehabilitation Act.
Let me ask you this. If there hadn't been a settlement agreement and Mr. Holmes had just retired from his job on October 6, 2004, you agree that the government would have been justified in deducting the almost $60,000 from his retirement annuity, don't you?
Yes, indeed I do, Your Honor. And that's just that leads to my next point. This is, you can retire under something other than the normal rules. This is a settlement agreement that involves something other than the normal rules. If we look at the language itself, in paragraph 1B, it indicates that Mr. Holmes shall be deemed to have retired or voluntarily resigned his employment with the agency. You're not ordinarily deemed to have retired. And then if he doesn't retire, he's deemed to have resigned. You're not ordinarily deemed to resign. This is a bargain for exchange. We look at the date that's used, October 6th, 2004. Mr. Holmes was, I'm sorry.
But see, it seems to me a lot of the arguments that you made on in your brief and this one you're making now were not covered by the text of the agreement. The agreement doesn't say anything about how the annuity would be calculated, doesn't say anything about this high three salary, doesn't say anything about military time. I mean, I think that's a problem for you because the agreement is silent.
Now, certainly, lawyering can always be better. Agreements can always be better written. No, it doesn't explicitly state out exactly what benefits are going to be associated with Mr. Holmes' retirement, but it doesn't also say he's going to retire under the normal rules either. I think there's some burden on the U.S. Postal Service if they want him to retire under the normal rules to put that in the agreement. In this instance, we have a representation made at the mediation. This is what you're going to get. You know, probably, Your Honor, it's not in there. I had the privilege of learning under Professor Bodensteiner, who represented Mr. Holmes in this case at Valparaiso Law School, as have a lot of other lawyers. And it's difficult for me to sit here and judge him for saying this should have been written better when at the mediation he's probably relying on the government to follow through with its promise that this is what you're going to get per month. In fact, this Mr. Holmes' position here is bolstered and supported by the June 10th and July 2nd annuity estimates that are set out. So we have a settlement conference in May. It says, Mr. Holmes, you're going to get $34.51 a month, plus you're going to get restored retroactively. You're going to get paid your attorney's fees and some other things. And then it's confirmed in June. It's confirmed in July. It's not until 6.5 months later that the government appears to change its mind. And it's worth noting that there could be some some bad intent on the government's part here. The government's certainly familiar with the numbers that are promised and relied upon at mediation in exchange for the settlement. And then the government 6.5 months later says, oh, you know, we're going to do this because we can, because the settlement agreement doesn't preclude us from doing this. We're now going to change our minds and
that's the import of a merger clause in a contract, right? If you don't include specific terms in the writing, then you're out. And you don't have an argument later on in court I just don't see how you get around that. If this agreement was meant to cover the terms of his retirement as opposed to the date, then those terms should have been included in the writing, and they weren't. And we've got a merger clause, and you can't get around that.
Well, you do have the standard merger clause, legal boilerplate, that is there. However, in this instance,
they always say legal boilerplate.
I know, we see it a lot. I think the judges certainly, I've even seen it a lot in my few years of practice. But what we have here, let's take two pieces of evidence and put them together, okay? We have
we don't look to outside evidence. That's the whole point of the merger clause.
To what's been designated in response to the summary judgment, at least. And if you're saying, okay, here's this merger clause that says there's nothing else, it's important to know that this settlement is in the this document is in the context of a settlement of some claims that Mr. Holmes brought. It's not the ordinary sense. And this court, this circuit, has repeatedly held that where there's ambiguity in a contract, you can use objective evidence to show that there's ambiguity in a contract. We've done that with the two annuity estimates. Those evidence suggest that the government shares the same position that Mr. Holmes shares for the first several months after the settlement agreement.
Well, you can't use extrinsic evidence to create ambiguity, though, in an otherwise unambiguous contract, and there really isn't anything unambiguous about this.
One thing, though, I do want to point out on behalf of my client is a clause in a contract, the circuit has held repeatedly, can be ambiguous if it's subject to reasonable alternative interpretations. One reasonable alternative interpretation here is certainly the government's view. He gets to retire under the normal rules of retirement, nothing else. Another reasonable view is that we use the October 6th date, so Mr. Holmes is exactly 55 years old, has over 30 years of federal service. Now he's getting a full retirement, and this is supported by the government's own documents. There's your objective evidence to establish the ambiguity. That's also a reasonable alternative interpretation. And all we're asking this court is to let Mr. Holmes have his day in court. He's designated enough evidence to get past summary judgment because he's showing that there is a question about what the true intent of the parties is. And, Your Honor, just to also respond, this circuit has also held that the touchstone of contract interpretation is to determine the intent of the parties. And if it was the intent of the parties, under the facts viewed most favorable to Mr. Holmes, that he receive a full retirement, then I think certainly that's also a reasonable alternative interpretation. It's one the government shared the same understanding with him for many months.
This full retirement, I still get back to my first question. He would not have been entitled to this $60,000 under full retirement. Right? Because the annuity, he'd taken the $60,000 out, the $59,000 out.
Well, not if it was the government in settling this lawsuit, this rehabilitation.
Put him $60,000 ahead.
A waiver of the deficit? Maybe they're going to fill his account up? If you're Mr. Holmes and you're sitting there at mediation and they're coming in and telling you, he's evaluating this the only way he can. What am I going to get pre-retirement and what am I going to get post-retirement? And they're coming in saying you're going to get $34.51 a month. Maybe to Mr. Holmes that operates as the Postal Service is going to waive his deficit. Maybe it means he's going to get a real normal retirement here. Maybe they're going to fill up his account in order that he gets a normal retirement here. He's giving up a $71,000 a year job. He's giving up $200,000 potentially in claims against the government in this lawsuit. And those are the intentions of the parties, that he's going to be made whole here. It's at least a question of fact that we need to look further. It's at least a reasonable alternative interpretation. I often wonder, as I learn more and more about the law, at what point we become so concerned with legal rigidity that we lose sight of the substantial notions of fair play and substantial justice.
What you're talking about is an equitable case. This is not an equitable case. It's a contract case.
Yes.
And fireside equity is not appropriate.
Oh, I understand, Your Honor. I just think that...
You can cry if you want.
Your Honor, you're the only jury my client has. And we're fine with that. But we think that we meet the legal standards to at least show we've got a reasonable alternative interpretation. The government could also have said, we're going to retire him under normal rules. The government should be held to what the numbers were that were relied on between the parties. The government never says in their summary judgment motion, oh, by the way, we never even agreed to these numbers. No, what they say is...
I understand you're in your rebuttal time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll reserve it.
Not yet. Well, you've got a couple more minutes.
Oh, okay.
If you want to save some time, you can.
I'll save some time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Reed?
If the court please, I am Joe Reed. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney, Northern District of Indiana. I represent the Postmaster General, who is the appellee in this case. I wanted to make three quick points and sit down, but I have to respond to a couple that Mr. Massey made. First of all, this notion of full retirement, I'm somewhat I don't understand that one, because there was a break in service, the record here, a break in service in 1993, followed by an EEO in 1993 or sometime around that time. While the appellant was not working, he apparently borrowed against or withdrew from his retirement savings. I've always been offended, is not the right word, but until I can think of a better one. I've always been offended that parties go to a mediation. They don't directly communicate with each other. They're put in separate rooms, and the mediator, that's the evidence here, shuffles back and forth between the two rooms, working with each party, saying who knows what he says to try to help them get their case settled. The only party at that mediation armed with the knowledge that this gentleman made a withdrawal, a personal loan or a personal withdrawal from his pension account, is not the Postmaster General, is not the postal attorney, is not the plant manager in Gary, Indiana, when his other withdrawal was in Minnesota. That's something personal and known to him, and why that wouldn't have been raised with the mediator when they're bantering these numbers around. And then we basically have a suit to get another $60,000 has always been a puzzle to me. I don't get that.
In that regard, he's really asking for a better than full retirement, and he wants to be paid twice.
In that regard, yes, because the other way I think that I look at it is that, well, yeah, you borrowed the money against your pension, or you withdrew it from your pension, and you want $3,000 a month or whatever that number would give you, put it back in and you get your $3,000 a month.
That's a windfall.
If you got the extra 60, yes. Yes, I think so.
But I wouldn't be offended if I were you. People like money for some reason.
The other point I want to make is,
counsel tries to argue that there were all these other claims he gave up, and so that's why the government was so generous in terms of the pension amount, you know, that all these other claims were dismissed, and so that's why we should.
My only response to that is we have a written contract that is complete on its face, and not only is it complete on its face, it's got an integration clause. That's the agreement of the parties. We're going to get you off the employment rolls as of a date certain, and from the time you last were working, which was about a 18-month or two-year period, we're going to bridge that gap with 20 hours of leave without pay and 20 hours of paid administrative leave at these annual rates, and that was done. And
that was actually fairly generous under the facts here, as I understand them, since he hadn't been working any of that time, right?
Yes.
And so it's technically chargeable with taking that time at unpaid status.
I hate to get into generous or not generous. We're dealing with the written document, right. And it means what it says, and it says what it means, and it's complete on its face. And
that should be the end of that.
And that's the end. And that should be the end of my argument too, unless you have questions.
Atta boy.
We have no questions, Mr. Reed. How much time is Mr. Massey here? 1 minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Holmes wasn't the only one armed with the knowledge of his file. He presumes that the Postal Service is fully knowledgeable. They're represented by capable counsel. As far as prior withdrawals...
But the pension agency is not the Postal Service. Those are two separate entities.
The pension agency operates under what the Postal Service gives them and tells them, and the Postal Service certainly can enter into a settlement agreement here. I don't think anyone can say with certainty what he gave up was a good settlement or a bad settlement. We never got that far. He might have had the greatest rehabilitation claim in the world. Certainly to Mr. Holmes, he settled his 1994 case with Minnesota. There's a settlement document that says any documents to do with this case are going to be removed from his file. He has no reason to believe this is going to be resurrected when he's relying on the numbers that were provided in this case at the mediation. All we have to show is a reasonable alternative interpretation to get past summary judgment. He's just asking for his day in court to show the intent of the parties in this case. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for fine arguments. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll call case numbers.